Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Project Interfaith on Noon Forum. We'll hear a lecture by Sahar Aziz, Associate Professor of Law at the Texas Wesleyan University School of Law and former Senior Policy Advisor for the Office of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties at the United States Department of Homeland Security. She'll speak on the topic Then and Now, Civil Liberties and Interfaith Relations 10 Years After 9/11. Ms. Aziz's appearance is co-sponsored, along with Project Interfaith, by the Center for Faith Studies. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Sunday afternoon, September 11, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Project Interfaith, the Center for Faith Studies, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Beth Katz, Executive Director of Project Interfaith.
Ms. Aziz is an Associate Professor of Law at Texas Wesleyan School of Law and frequently writes about national security and civil rights issues for a variety of media sites. She served as a Senior Policy Advisor at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. She offers a unique perspective for walking that fine line in keeping our country safe, yet protecting the rights of all our citizens. After Ms. Aziz's presentation, we will have time for questions and answers from the microphones in the aisles. Please use this time to consider a question that honors the topic and our audience. Because of our limited time together, this is a time for questions only. And please avoid making statements or telling your own personal story. We do invite you to make statements and share your stories with others afterwards, but unfortunately today we are limited in time and really want to keep the conversation focused and moving forward.
And now let us welcome Sahar Aziz to the podium.
Thank you so much for having me here today, and thank you to Beth and Cindy for their tireless efforts in making this wonderful event happen. And thanks to all the faith-based organizations that co-sponsored it. I'm truly honored to be here. It's also nostalgic to be visiting the neighbor state of my former home in Laramie, Wyoming, where I spent a carefree and memorable childhood. Now, I'd like to start my talk today with a quote that inspires me and has inspired me for the last 10 years. Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Those were the words of Thomas Paine, one of the founding fathers, in 1777, a year after the United States obtained its independence. He had the foresight to know back then that freedom is not a privilege, but rather a right that must be defended. After 10 years of fighting for the freedoms that our founding fathers fought and died for, I am admittedly fatigued. I am taxed by the heavy burden of fighting for the rights embedded in our Constitution. The right to practice religion freely, no matter how strange or unfamiliar it may be to the majority. The right to speak one's mind, no matter how unpopular or offensive it may be. And the right to do so without the government harassing you, spying on you, and intimidating you into silence based on a false premise that because you or your parents immigrated to the United States, that your citizenship is worth less than someone born here of many generations. That is not the America of our founding fathers. That is not the America that our men and women in the military risk their lives for. Our America is the country that can honestly proclaim that it is a beacon of freedom to which other countries can look up to. And because of that, I'm willing to undergo the fatigue of supporting freedom, because eternal vigilance is the price of freedom, whether here in the United States or across the ocean in the Middle East, where Arabs and Muslims are sacrificing their lives to be free from tyranny. It is truly momentous for me to be standing here today in the United States of America as an Egyptian-born American citizen, a child of Egyptian immigrant parents, reflecting on how the past 10 years have affected all American civil rights and civil liberties. Exactly 31 years from February 11, 2011, the day the Egyptian people peacefully deposed a brutal dictator, my parents immigrated to your neighbor state, Wyoming, to create a better life for me and my siblings. At a young age, my parents were confronted with the harsh reality of the injustices of Egyptian society in the 1970s. Corruption was rampant, and success was determined more by who you knew and who your father was, as opposed to your intelligence and your hard work. Coming from a middle-class family that prided itself on its integrity and honesty, my father was faced with a very difficult choice of remaining in his native country among his siblings, his friends, and his parents, to live the impoverished life of the honest man, or to immigrate to a country that rewarded him for his mathematical brilliance and extraordinary work ethic. He chose the latter and paid a very high price for it. Having lived in a household of immigrants, I can tell you from personal experience that many of us, including myself, would not have the strength to be so far away from home, in a foreign land, having to learn a new language and face the unfamiliarity of a new social, economic, and political system. For those who misguidedly accuse immigrants of coming to America to be lazy free riders, seeking to steal Americans of opportunities, they clearly have no idea about the hardships involved with leaving one's homeland. Not only emotionally, but also economically. Many of my parents' friends from Egypt and other Middle Eastern countries were forced to drive taxi cabs, work in factories, and tend at gas stations, despite having medical degrees and engineering degrees from their home countries. People who labored for years in college in their country of origin were forced to take a decrease in status in order to be in a country that provided equal opportunity for their children and thus a better economic future. But despite these challenges, they came here believing they could live the American dream, and they were willing to pay their fair share to earn it. And so you can imagine the pain that it caused me and my generation of fellow Arab Americans and Muslim Americans when our loyalty was questioned because of 19 men's criminal acts, men that we have nothing to do with, men who are complete strangers to us. We kept asking ourselves, why do some of my fellow Americans believe that just because I may have the same skin tone or the same nose structure or the same hair texture or even profess the same faith as someone, that I'm guilty of their crimes? How does this fit into the individualism that I was taught in my elementary school in Laramie, Wyoming? Indeed, this very individualism and self-determination has caused us to be trailblazers within our own ethnic communities, especially as women. When we refuse to conform without first being convinced with rational and logical explanations. And when we are not convinced, we dare to challenge customs and traditions because we were taught in school and in our homes to think for ourselves as individuals. We live our American values every day. But it was as if all those fundamental values were washed away in one swoop on that tragic day of September 11, 2001. Before we had a chance to fully grieve for the victims of 9/11, of all religions and all races, and the courageous first responders, we were suddenly under attack within our own country. And I don't think any of us will ever forget where we were on 9/11. I know I never will. And after being told way too many times that I was too aggressive, too argumentative for a woman. Yes, ladies in the audience, you know that stereotype all too well. I had decided to become a lawyer, where I could make a living out of arguing. I was eager to start my life as a full-time paid argumentative professional woman. And so it happened that on September 11, 2001, I was a first-year law student at the University of Texas in Austin. We were in between classes on our first week when I saw everyone huddled in front of the television in shock, crying and screaming in disbelief. We all stood there dazed and not knowing what we were watching, if it was real or manufactured. It was nothing short of surreal. And I will never forget the moment when my heart dropped as the commentators started to speculate that it was Muslim hijackers from the Middle East that were behind this tragic event. This was the moment that I knew that I would be thrust into defending the U.S. Constitution for many years to come. And as someone who had been exposed to different cultures and religions, I knew all too well about the human tendency to generalize and seek scapegoats for injustices in this world. Oftentimes, those selected are the politically weak, the economically poor, and the unfamiliar. It is not an American problem. It's a human problem. That fateful and tragic day of September 11th set into motion a 10-year struggle that I continue until today to defend the civil rights and civil liberties of all Americans. Now, yes, it started out with a focus on Muslims and Arabs and South Asians, because they were indisputably the most adversely affected. As the public and the government saw through the fog of debris and shock and trauma, they rightfully sought to punish those responsible for this historic wrong. Unfortunately, the criteria used to determine who was to blame became the color of one's skin, the nation of one's origin, and the religion that one professed. Many innocent Arabs and Muslims were rounded up and jailed indefinitely. They had no idea why they were imprisoned, nor did they have any idea who those 19 hijackers were or why they had carried out this horrendous act in the name of their religion. Many of these people were summarily deported after having lived in the United States for many years and sometimes decades. Others were eventually released with a very different perspective on the country they had flocked to for freedom and happiness. And at the same time, many Muslim charities were shut down, sending shockwaves through Muslim communities nationwide. Giving charity is one of the five tenets of Islam, and much of that money went to humanitarian aid to impoverished civilians trapped in conflict zones such as Kashmir, Gaza, and Somalia, where right now there is currently one of the worst droughts in history that has killed millions of people, including countless women and children. Had these charities still existed today, tens of millions of dollars could have been directed towards food aid to Somalis in desperate need. But when the vehicles in which Muslims practiced charity were summarily closed and the religious charitable funds were frozen, the result was a tremendous chilling effect on religious freedom practices among Muslims. Many were scared to give charity, believing that even the most tenuous association with a Muslim charity or a mosque could lead to ruinous consequences. But unfortunately, it wasn't just the government that had decided to collectively punish these communities. Many members of the public also directed their anger and their pain at Muslims. Some Americans harassed their Muslim co-workers as they accused them of causing the September 11th attacks. They called them terrorists, Taliban, sand nigger, camel jockey, and told them to go home, as if their American citizenship was null and void. Muslim women wearing headscarves reminded the public of the religion believed to have inspired the terrorism, causing them to be physically attacked and their children to be bullied in school. 10 years later, these incidences have yet to abate, and so there is still much work to be done. Now, I realize that there may be people in the audience who do not agree with my critical interpretation of events and who may believe it is worth being overly zealous in protecting our national security. Are we not at war with crazy, irrational, and inhumane terrorists who killed thousands of our citizens that day? But I would caution you not to lose sight of what is really at stake here. It is not the rights of a few million Americans. It is your rights. It is all of our rights, regardless of our faith, national origin, or number of generations we have lived in this country. For these were exactly the set of circumstances that our founding fathers envisioned when they drafted our timeless Constitution. So when government officials oppose giving a fair trial in our federal court system on those accused of terrorism, I am troubled. We have a moral obligation to ensure those whom we deny liberty are in fact guilty of the crimes of which they have been accused, no matter how vicious their crimes may have been. We should take heed of the wise words of Judge Kaplan in New York, who presided over the first civilian trial of a Guantanamo detainee. And he said, "The court is acutely aware of the perilous nature of the world in which we live, but the Constitution is the rock upon which our nation rests. We must follow it not only when it is convenient, but when fear and danger beckon in a different direction. To do less would diminish us and undermine the foundation upon which we stand." So the First Amendment was not promulgated to protect the majority or popular opinion. It was aimed at protecting those who expressed views that were controversial, unpopular, or simply unfamiliar to the majority of Americans. Whether the person is white, black, Latino, Asian, Jewish, or Muslim, a woman or a man, the First Amendment protects you from being jailed, tortured, or killed on account of your political beliefs. And our First Amendment also makes you free to worship or not to worship, as you please, without government interference or persecution. It is because of this priceless right that so many of us in this room today have different beliefs and values and still have the opportunities to get an education, a job, and live freely. So if someone tries to strip you of that right to believe, think, and speak as you wish, the law is on your side. The courts are bound by law to be an objective and neutral forum for the popular as well as the unpopular, the rich and the poor, the male and the female, to ensure the Constitution is applied fairly and consistently. But in those first few years after 9/11, we had a crisis of faith. We allowed our fears to trump our values. We gave our government unfettered discretion as they proclaimed, "Just trust us." This approach has time and time again throughout our history led to an erosion of civil rights and civil liberties for many Americans of various backgrounds, whether the Irish, the Italians, the Germans, or the Japanese. We were not raised to blindly follow our government's instructions without first determining if they are reasonable, in accordance with the law, and not a waste of our taxpayer dollars. So when our fears trump our values, we allow ourselves to come dangerously close, to going over a precipitous cliff that could fundamentally change our country for the worse. The first instance was when we passed the Patriot Act. In an unprecedented 45 days, with no hearings, no debate, and no deliberation. This is in comparison to the usual process where it can take months or years to debate and pass a bill through Congress. As a matter of process and due diligence, 45 days is simply not enough time for our congressional leaders and the public to carefully weigh the repercussions of 150 sections that would make major changes to our laws that deeply affect our civil rights. And indeed, we soon discovered the serious flaws that are not so easy to reverse. One particularly troubling aspect of the Patriot Act is the expanded authority granted to the executive branch to issue national security letters, to demand our records from businesses and other institutions without any showing of reasonable suspicion to believe that criminal activity has occurred. National security letters are administrative subpoenas that do not require the FBI to go to a court and obtain a judge's approval. Rather, the FBI has full discretion to decide when to issue one, and there is no check by the judiciary before the fact. These letters give them the right to access our business records, as well as our personal medical records, bank records, and educational records. But most troublingly, it grants the government the authority to spy on what we are reading. And librarians who received these requests about our reading habits were prohibited at one point by the Patriot Act from telling anyone about the national security letter or else they would face prosecution. That is not our America. But I will tell you what is our America. Our America is epitomized when a group of courageous librarians in Connecticut decided that they were not going to participate in the violation of the Constitution, knowing they were risking their liberty by disclosing their receipt of national security letters to their lawyers because the gag order was all-inclusive. And saying that they could not tell anyone of its existence, including their lawyers. They decided it was the right thing to do, to sue the government, to challenge the constitutionality of the gag orders and the basis of the requests. After years of litigation, they eventually won their case that resulted in declaring the gag orders unconstitutional. This was a victory not only for the librarians, but for our Constitution. Now, while national security letters can still be issued without a court order, thanks to these patriotic Americans, a recipient can now file a suit in court to challenge the letter's legitimacy without being prosecuted for violating a gag order. It shines the light on this practice to ensure the authority is not abused. So before the government issues a national security letter, they know that they may one day have to defend their decision before a judge. And that check on government power is a fundamental bastion of our civil liberties. Now, I wish I could end my speech here and say that all we need to do to restore our civil liberties is to fully debate and reform the Patriot Act, which certainly needs to be done. But unfortunately, the past 10 years have included other legal changes that have proven to be in direct contradiction with our values of freedom and democracy. The rise of fusion centers and the suspicious activity reports they produce is increasingly encroaching on our daily lives. Fusion centers are state entities that are supposed to analyze and share criminal information to bolster the efficacy of law enforcement's crime-finding mandate. They were initially started to focus on countering terrorism, but they have expanded their mission to burglary rings, drug conspiracies, chop shops, gang violence, and other criminal activities. Now, facially, that sounds quite reasonable and uncontroversial. In fact, it is consistent with the 9/11 Commission's recommendation that the absence of intelligence sharing between law enforcement agencies contributed to the 9/11 attacks. But the problem lies in the lack of transparency about the fusion centers and the apparent lack of legal standards on which information is gathered. For example, do the fusion centers gather intelligence about us based on a reasonable suspicion that a criminal act is occurring or about to occur? Is it based on a probable cause standard? Or do they create suspicious activity reports based on a hunch because they just don't like the way we look? Or because we are taking pictures or making a list, which are listed as examples of suspicious activity reports for law enforcement to look out for? Now, any competent law enforcement professional will tell you that this is bad practice, and it simply wastes their time focusing on innocent people while criminals go undetected. And any civil liberties advocate will tell you that such practices are almost a guarantee for pervasive civil liberties violations and a recipe for profiling based on gender, race, religion, and socioeconomic class. But unfortunately, there are increasing reports of surveillance activities in various states directed at actions clearly and inarguably protected by the First Amendment. The expanded definition of what domestic terrorism is seems to now include people who engage in mainstream political activities, including nonviolent protests. One very telling example is in 2005 and in 2006 in Maryland. The Maryland State Police engaged in covert infiltration and intelligence gathering of anti-war and anti-death penalty groups. They identified them as terrorists, and disseminated intelligence gathered into national law enforcement databases. When lawful anti-death penalty and anti-war activism is improperly categorized as terrorism, we are wasting precious law enforcement resources, and we're corrupting criminal intelligence databases with irrelevant information. Other similar incidents occurred in Florida when a Florida fusion center spied on Ron Paul supporters and other political groups, including anti-war protests organized by Code Pink, Veterans for Peace, and Greenpeace. The fusion center also reported on a demonstration against BP during the Gulf oil spill crisis. In Pennsylvania, anti-tax protesters, including a neighborhood group opposed to shale gas drilling, was labeled as, quote, a threat to the state's infrastructure, end quote, by Homeland Security. Now, when the proper surveillance was exposed, or improper surveillance, the Pennsylvania governor, Ed Rennell, at the time, stated that he was deeply embarrassed by the disclosure and said, "Let me make this as clear as I can. Protesting is not a threat against infrastructure. Protesting is a God-given American right." Meanwhile, a member of the group opposed to drilling poignantly stated, quote, "I thought this was a free country, and I was allowed to have my own opinion. Now what, you're going to watch me in every move I make? That's not right." That is not our America. We will not allow this country to become one where we must self-censor out of fear that we are being spied upon for our lawful political and religious viewpoints. We will not allow this country to bar free and honest debates about important public policy issues ranging from our economic woes to our foreign policy. Some of you may already know that you all have a fusion center in Nebraska, and it states on its website that it too uses, quote, "a suspicious activity reporting tool that will provide citizens and law enforcement officials the ability to report significant incidents they may encounter in their daily lives. This information will immediately be forwarded to the appropriate intelligence group for further analysis and dissemination," end quote. That's from their website. Now, in light of what has happened in other states, you have a responsibility of knowing, as a citizen of this great state of Nebraska, about the criteria applied for creating suspicious activity reports on you. You have a right to know what oversight mechanisms are in place to ensure your political or religious beliefs and practices are not the basis for a suspicious activity report. And in these tough economic times, you need to know if your taxpayer money is being efficiently expended to make the best use of law enforcement's limited resources. So I encourage you to become an informed citizen that develops a constructive relationship with law enforcement and a relationship that keeps in mind the wise words of Thomas Paine: "Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must undergo the fatigue of supporting it." So here we are, 10 years after that awful day when our nation was put to the test. We sit here commemorating the lives lost on that day and in gratitude to the first responders who too gave their lives so that others could live, who were taken from their children and their spouses so that others could remain on earth to be mothers and fathers and spouses to their families. We have not forgotten that day, nor shall we ever, but we will also not allow it to change what defines us. We will not allow it to rob us of our spirit of tolerance, ingenuity, and openness to the world. We are a country built on the sweat and faith of immigrants who flocked here from every corner of the earth. We are a nation that is deeply indebted to its indigenous Native American populations who were almost annihilated so that our country could exist. We are a nation that would not be where we are without the contributions of African American citizens whose courage during the Civil Rights Movement taught my community that we can overcome any hardship. And we are a nation that has one of the most thriving Jewish populations in the world, that has successfully fought back against the rampant anti-Semitism of the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, when Jewish lawyers had to start their own law firms because no one would hire them. These lawyers have left a legacy of civil rights litigation that have inspired many in my generation, including myself, to protect civil rights for all Americans. We are a nation that will continue to welcome those who believe that hard work, willpower, and integrity are the building blocks of success in America. Whether you are black, white, Latino, Asian, or Arab, whether you are Jewish, Muslim, Christian, or Sikh, our America is still a land of opportunity to those willing to work hard and pay their fair share towards the common good. And our diligence in protecting our Constitution will ensure that our America is one where all of our civil rights are protected through the good times and the bad. Because no matter how painful that day of 10 years past, that single event does not even come close to shaking the strong foundation on which this country was built. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Sahar, for sharing your thoughtful insights. We really appreciate them. We now ask that those who have a question for Sahar, please form a line behind one of the two microphones, and we will have about a 30-minute period of question and answers. Really quickly, while people are coming up to the mic, Sahar, I just had a question for you. So your background, you've worked at the Department of Homeland Security. That was part of what kind of fascinated us, is that you've both seen it externally and internally. So can you speak a little bit, though, because obviously you are very concerned with civil liberties and protection of civil rights, but what criteria do you then find to be a fair criteria in terms of assessing a security risk? Right. And what would be appropriate protocol then in that case, right, from your perspective?
Well, I don't think it's anything revolutionary or new. It's essentially, to me, terrorism is a type of crime. And we've been fighting crime since, you know, every country fights crime. And I think we do a pretty good job of it. So to me, it's more about what's the improper criteria. So obviously race, gender, religion, ethnic origin. So that is just off the table as far as I'm concerned. So what's happening now is there's a shift in what they call behavioral profiling, as they call it, and I think they're actually doing it in the airport, and it's the SPOT program that's public information, which is, it's fascinating. It's a tough issue, because on the one hand, so behavioral profiling is when you're looking for someone who looks nervous, who looks like they're sweating, something's not right. But at the same time, there's also very innocent circumstances when someone is in that state. So how do you distinguish between someone who's up to something bad and has some kind of illicit intent and someone who's just having a really bad day? So the easy case is it's the middle of the summer and someone's wearing a big coat. Okay, that's easy. Right? But not a woman who's Muslim and she's wearing a headscarf. And that doesn't necessarily mean she's hiding a bomb underneath her scarf. So part of it is also cultural familiarity. Now, the behavioral profiling has changed to this. I think psychologists are working on it, where they literally look at your macro movement and your micro movements. It's really fascinating. And they have some way of being able to tell through your eye movements and your facial movements and your body language whether you look like you're up to no good. Okay, I think facially that sounds reasonable. The only thing that I ask, and we did this in the government, but one thing I learned being in the government is that the public plays a significant role. If the public isn't pressuring the public essentially prioritizes the issues for the government. When you're in the government, you are deluged with issues. There's so much to do. It's really hard to govern, right? A nation of 350 million people. or 300 million people. So there's crises from natural disasters to et cetera. So the public prioritizes. And then when they brings it, whether it's through the media, investigative reporting, or lobbying, or electoral politics. So what would happen in that case is, like, some groups came and said, that's fine with us, but what we don't want you to do is, for example, if you have someone who's a new immigrant who doesn't look you in the eye, it might not be because they're up to no good. It might be because in their culture, they're very deferential to authority. And to them, it's rude to look someone that has authority in the eye. But in our culture, that is usually a sign of guilt. Why aren't you looking at me? What are you hiding? Why are your eyes shifting? So those are the types of nuances that I think the government needs to understand so that they do not mistake innocent behavior for illegal behavior. That's just one example. You have to take it in various contexts. That was, like, for example, the airport example. Mm-hmm. So,
great. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yes, over here.
Okay, thank you. With the exception of a few examples of the judiciary getting it right, would you agree that the United States Supreme Court, with its decisions in Twombly and Iqbal, making it harder to state a claim, and with its decisions with respect to but-for causation in employment discrimination case, and its decision in the recent class action ruling making it much harder for people to band together to seek justice against corporations, wouldn't you agree that the United States Supreme Court is not acting as a check and balance on the unfettered actions of the legislative and executive branches?
Well, that's a great question. I used to practice employment discrimination law, so on the plaintiff's side, so I certainly have a lot of empathy for the challenges of filing civil rights claims. Unfortunately, you know, this trend has been going on before 9/11. Some would argue it started as far back as the 70s as kind of a backlash to the civil rights movement and a pushback on the affirmative action policies that had started to become increasingly controversial and created some resentment within certain pockets of the population. So I am admittedly not a fan of the Roberts Court. I think that they have made some decisions that are increasingly, at least apparently, politicized and highly influenced by the interest of the private sector, particularly corporations. So I do agree with you in that implied theme in your question. I think that the solution is, as it always is if you can't win through the Supreme Court, then you have to legislate around it, which means you have to mobilize, which means you have to go and get out the vote, and you need to hold your elected officials accountable, and you need to teach them that, you know, this Supreme Court decision has a tremendous negative effect on so many people, particularly workers, because that's the system that we function in. I think you're right, though. It's a fair conclusion to make that it has become increasingly more difficult to win civil rights claims, whether they're in employment or other contexts, through the courts. And I'm not sure if the American population understands it. I think, or appreciates the problem. I think one misconception is that people think civil rights only affects a very small percentage of Americans. And oftentimes people think, well, that's not me. But in fact, that is a complete fallacy. Whether you're a woman, a racial minority, you could be a man, you could be, you know, I would like to say civil rights protects you if you're gay, but unfortunately, that, at least under employment law, that hasn't gotten to that point yet. But they actually, you know, Section 1983 claim, for example, which protects you from state and local officials abusing your civil rights, has nothing to do with race and nothing to do with gender. And I teach that often in my classes, and my students are kind of shocked because people think, well, that's for this really small group of people who feels entitled to be above the law. That is a fallacy. And oftentimes they don't realize it until it's them that gets passed over for promotion or pay or feels abused by law enforcement and realize when they go talk to a lawyer that the rights are on paper, but in practice they're hollow. So I would just conclude by saying you've got to legislate around it. That's the way the system works at this point. Or you file new cases with better facts and try to get a better outcome.
Right over here.
Yeah, I wondered if you knew anything about the I saw recently on Frontline that almost 1 million people have been hired in a the secret government, mm-hmm. and that there's no oversight, either financial or otherwise, in terms of what they do. And I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that, what you know about that, and right. if there's been any legal way to challenge that.
Okay. Yeah, that's a great question. There's a new book that just came out called Top Secret America that's by Dana Priest. She's a Washington Post reporter, and it's an accumulation of many of her investigative reports. And it's, I think, a must-read for anyone who's interested in what can be termed as a security industrial complex that seems to have arisen out of the past 10 years. It's very, very difficult. Well, one, because it's not transparent. It's very difficult to know what's going on. So it's also very difficult to litigate. When you finally do litigate around something, for example, whether it's related to fraud, you know, waste of taxpayer money or civil rights, for example, there was a case, it's still pending, of Jefferson, Muhammad V. Jefferson, which is an individual who was a victim of the rendition program where people were sent by our government, our CIA, to primarily Middle Eastern countries to be tortured, because we couldn't torture them on our land because we had laws that protected against that. And so he sued the corporation that flew him, that the CIA or someone, I'm not sure which agency exactly, hired to fly him, to drug him and fly him to, I think it was Egypt in that case. And what happens is the government invokes a state secrets privilege, which has been abused to no end. I mean, it's a big critique against the Obama administration because he hasn't changed that, although he had promised to do so during his campaign. So the state secrets privilege essentially says, okay, you file a case, you file your complaint, and then the first procedural point is a motion to dismiss. So you try to file a motion to dismiss. Well, the government will say, okay, judge, you need to dismiss this because in order for us to proceed, we're going to have to disclose confidential classified information. And if we do that, we're going to risk national security, and therefore the case is closed, without going to the merits, without figuring out whether or not he really did get tortured or did anyone violate the law. And so it just ends the case right there, which, of course, is completely contradictory to rule of law. So that has been an issue that, frankly, I think, you know, I would advise everyone to get up to speed on, because it's a public policy issue, and it's preventing, I mean, if you don't care as much about kind of the torture civil rights context, you should certainly care about the economic waste, the fraud that's been happening, because there's no one to keep them in check, and every time someone sues, it gets dismissed. So I guess my response is yes, it is an issue, it's been documented, and I would just highlight that this is exactly why transparency is so important as a matter of law, as a matter of rule of law, is if we don't have transparency in our system and we constantly allow the government to use national security as a guise to do everything in secret, in the end, we end up the losers as a society.
Yes, over here. First, I want to thank you so much for the balanced perspective that you've brought, and for I agree with everything that you said. As you may know, Nebraska has the oldest peace and justice organization in the United States, and we lobbied for a whole year against the war in Iraq, and we worked really hard against the Patriot Act. But it feels as if nothing we can do as citizens really has any impact on our legislators, unless we're with the status quo. So I'm wondering if you have any advice about how we can be more effective in protecting our civil liberties and in working against so many of the negative responses that we had to 9/11.
Right. No, I empathize. When I was in law school, I was within that group of people with, you know, the Patriot Act just passed when I was in law school. So it's not easy. I mean, it's never been easy to change the system, but, you know, there's a reason why we do it the way we do, so that we don't end up breaking out in a civil war every time people disagree. I would just advise you to do just much more coalition building and identifying maybe unusual allies or untraditional bedfellows, as they say, whether it's certain minority communities who are being impacted for different reasons in different ways, and other people who may have more political, ideological objectives or incentives. So, for example, oftentimes, ironically, the far right, the libertarians, will ally with the left, but they have a different reason. You know, maybe they want small government, and maybe the left just doesn't agree with the civil rights or aspect of it, or their surveillance aspect. So it's really about coalition building, and I would just tell you to take note of what the Tea Party is doing. Even whether you agree with them or not, you have to give them credit that they have been very successful in shaping the political landscape. They got people into Congress who are now shaking things up, and they're doing something right. I think they might be also copying Obama's model, who got him into power. So it's just, you've got to inform the people. You have to tell them how it affects their daily life. Because if people think it doesn't affect them, they're just not going to go out of their busy schedules to address these issues. Right over here.
Assalamu alaikum, Sahar. Welcome to Omaha.
Oh, thank you.
I have a question. Have you experienced an increasing number of law enforcement officers pressuring Muslims to spy on their own community or to become informants because of some slight issue in their own background, say we won't press these charges if you tell us all you know?
Right. Well, I'm assuming that you're referring to the recent reports that came out. In August, there are three really great investigative reports that frankly verified a lot of people's concerns, validated their concerns within these communities. Harper's Magazine came out with a report, I think it's called To Be an Informant. And Mother Jones came out with a report, and the Associated Press came out with a report on the NYPD and CIA working together in spying on mosques and coffee shops and cafes where Muslims tend to congregate. So if you look those three up, you'll find them there. They were all published in August, and they kind of blew your mind if you weren't familiar with what was going on. So the facts on the ground seem to say yes. Now, the government says no, but the government has to say no, because if they say yes, it's going to be used against them in court as an admission. So I wouldn't, if I was their lawyer, I wouldn't advise them to say yes anyway. But there's something awry, because what these reports showed was, for one, there's 15,000 informants right now. That's, if you believe the Associated Press or Harper's Magazine, there's three of them, so I'm going to get a little confused, but one of them said there were 15,000 informants, and most of them are paid. Some of them get paid up to $100,000. Many of them are usually in financial straits, so they're desperate for money. Ex-felons or people who have a problem with their immigration status, and the government tells them, look, and this, by the way, is really common in law enforcement, it's not just to terrorism or to Muslims, is they'll say, if you work with us, we'll figure out a way to make that violation go away. And that's how they get informants. And so these people have an incentive to find something wrong. And sometimes they do find something, and it's a problem and good for them, and that's exactly what should be happening. But the concern is, more often than not, or at least at a proportion that is really causing concern, that they're really just fishing for information, and they're going out to these communities, and they're almost, it's very hard to prove an entrapment defense in law, in a court. I mean, the law is very weak, frankly. It's very hard to win an entrapment defense. But many people have said, you know, there is an in effect de facto entrapping people. For example, they'll take young men who have mental health issues, or they're going through some identity crisis, or they're just angry about something, or maybe they are watching these jihadist websites, but they haven't done anything, and they'll kind of bring them in. And suddenly, there's these reports coming out that the informant was a leading part of the plot. So then you start to worry. It's one thing if you're kind of going along, keeping track of this guy, and then you stop him. That's great. But if you're leading the plot, if you are kind of getting this person roused up and leading them to this point, I don't know if that's the best use of our resources. The other problem is you're scaring the heck out of these communities. There are people, and I've talked to many of them in my advocacy, that many people stopped going to the mosque after 9/11. I know women who took off their scarves after 9/11. Some of them started to put them back on. But many women got discriminated against in the workplace. They didn't want to wear it. And they started to feel that they don't know who around them is an informant. So imagine you're in this room, and you know for a fact after reading all this stuff that there's, you know, 10 or 15% of the people here are informants. What are you going to do? Well, you're going to watch your mouth is what you're going to do. I mean, some of you are going to be really tenacious like me and say, whatever, I'm going to say whatever I want. But most of us aren't going to say that. We're going to be scared, and we're going to censor ourselves, and we're going to limit ourselves, which is not what a free country functions as. And those of us who have originated from countries abroad that don't have freedom, because there is, like in Iraq, there were in Syria, for example, there are spies everywhere. and you couldn't speak your mind. So that's the concern, is you've got the legal issue, but then you in the law enforcement resources, you know, expending resources well, and then you've just got the more fundamental freedom issues that you just don't want to live in a society like that.
Great. Thank you. Over here.
Thank you, Sarah, for sharing your insights. And I think with your last comment, you may have addressed at least a portion of my question. But I was going to ask if you had insights into what Muslims throughout the United States have been doing in the last 10 years in reaction to 9/11. So you talked to some of it as far as the increasing fear within the community. But can you speak more to what people have been doing in a public way, mm-hmm. the organizations like national organizations in Washington, D.C., but as well as locally throughout different communities?
Right. You know, and I think, you know, it's kind of sad to say this, but 9/11 was a blessing in disguise for the communities. It's sad that that's what it took. But because they were under siege and because there was such an open and blatant bias against them that, you know, before 9/11, many of these communities really, because I was a civil rights advocate way before 9/11. I was fortunate. I consider myself very fortunate. I had a lot of African-American friends in the 90s who really faced a lot of discrimination, and they taught me that there are some real issues in society surrounding race. And so I had already been sensitized to these issues, and I remember going to the Muslim communities and saying, you know, there's a lot of disparities here in our society, and we should all be concerned about it. And many of them say, oh, that's not our problem. You know, we're doctors, we're engineers, we're part of the upper middle class. No one's ever going to discriminate against us. And then 9/11 happened. And suddenly, they were shocked. And it was people at their workplaces, it was people they knew for their whole lives, neighbors started to be afraid of them, and it was a real shock to their system. And so what it caused many to do, so different responses, some kind of huddled in and completely isolated themselves, stopped going to the mosque, tried to mind their own business, and thought, if I just keep my head down, maybe I can keep my job, I can keep my home, and I won't get physically, you know, abused. And then others, particularly in the young generation, including myself, said no. We're going to fight back because that's the American thing to do. And fighting back does not mean being, you know, aggressive or mean. Fighting back means we're going to preserve those values, and we are going to go out there and we're going to tell Americans, remember who you are. Remember your values. Don't forget what happened to the Japanese. Don't forget what happened to the Irish and the Germans and the Italians and the Jews. And I mean, it's unfortunate. It's just a story of our of every country, but we have a history. And so part of it is we went and started educating. So you've got many organizations, especially at the national level. You've got Muslim Advocates is a new organization that started about 5 or 6 years ago. Those are mainly lawyers, legal advocacy. There is the Council on American Islamic Relations has been there since the 90s, and they've actually been under attack. They've been accused of being the Muslim Brotherhood or some Islamist front. But at the grassroots, if you go to Chicago and L.A. and many other cities, they have actually mobilized and done a lot of outreach, even with law enforcement, and have gone to law enforcement and said, hey, this is who we are. Why don't you come and talk to us? Instead of spying on us and prosecuting us, why don't we have a conversation? Because we're just, you know, we're citizens. We're part of the people you're supposed to be protecting. You also have Muslim Public Affairs Council, MPAC, which is based in L.A. They've done a lot of public education and especially focusing on Hollywood and making sure that media depictions aren't negative, because that also plays a big role in kind of subconscious stereotyping. I have to say the ACLU has done an amazing job. The ACLU deserves so much credit, particularly on the litigation front. And I'm sure they did it because they care about the communities, but they did it more because they saw that the First Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, you know, there were some major constitutional issues, and they were the ones who were filing these lawsuits and going to the judges and saying, this can't happen. So even if the executive branch is going to go, you know, be very aggressive, the courts will keep them in check. And I know around the 9/11 anniversary, I mean, today and the last week, there's been many op-eds, many perspectives of the community, which I think is really good because everyone can then appreciate it. One thing I would note, though, is the last 10 years have really shown how diverse we are as a community. We disagree. You know, I take a very, very pro-civil rights, civil liberties approach. Other people take what I think is a bit too apologetic. It's too like, well, let me prove that I'm innocent. Let me prove that I'm a good person. Let me prove to you. And you know, to me, I'm like, I don't have to prove anything. I follow the law. I'm a lawyer, and I don't, unless you have to prove it, I don't have to prove it. I don't know who these 19 hijackers were. I have no idea who they were. I never met them in my life, and I don't know anything about them. And so why should I have to? So that's my approach. Not everybody agrees with me. You'll find other people that are much more, well, let's just take a different, you know, let's accept that as a necessary evil, and let's go and not be confrontational or not be perceived as belligerent, and let's just kind of reach out. And that's fine. I support that. We all have different roles. So I think the 9/11 attacks, you know, they are obviously very tragic, but for those communities, it was kind of, they forced them to have to become more active members of society, which they should have been doing in the first place. And it also forced the rest of society to get to know them.
Okay, I'm sorry, we're almost out of time. I'm going to take our last question over here.
Thank you, Professor, for coming this weekend. I appreciate it. I have a hypothetical question. Suppose Napolitano goes back to Arizona, where, you know, she'll run again against Jan Brewer or becomes senator there, and you're appointed as head of Department of Homeland Security.
I hate those hypotheticals.
A couple of short-term policies or changes that you would make to, one, the money that Homeland Security spends, and number two, policy changes that short-term you would immediately do or put into effect?
Well, that's a tough question. Well, first I've got to think about what jurisdiction I've got, because a lot of the stuff that I talked about today is under the Department of Justice. I think, coming from a civil rights perspective, I think Title VI has not been sufficiently enforced. Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act of 1964 essentially requires that if the federal government gives money to any state or local entity, that they are prohibited by law from using it to violate any civil rights statutes or constitutional rights. And otherwise, they lose the money. So it's the power of the purse, because, you know, you've got federalism issues where the government, you know, federal government can't tell the states what to do about everything. But they can control the power of the purse. And I don't think that's been implemented as much as it should be. And I think that will also keep states in check, because ultimately that's what matters. I mean, the states need the money, especially these days. So I would bolster the Title VI enforcement, which is under the Office for Civil Rights, which I used to work in. I would also create much more oversight of this intergovernment, the Joint Terrorism Task Forces, the Joint Terrorism Task Forces are when you've got the FBI, ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement, state police, local police, you know, all of these different parts of law enforcement working together. It is an outcome of, it's a direct, you know, response to the 9/11 Commission's recommendation that there needs to be more information sharing, because there's always that question, could we have stopped those hijackers if we had been sharing information? And many people think the answer is yes. There's a lot of turf wars, as you probably know, within government, law enforcement, and in the intelligence community. So I would create more oversight and make sure that there's nothing wrong with doing that, and I think it's a great idea. The problem is, if it's not monitored, it's very easy for people to operate on the lowest common denominator. So whatever's either easy, or if there's a lot of political pressure, you've got to find some scapegoats. You've got to boost your terrorism prosecution numbers. You've got to boost your terrorism investigation numbers, because the population's looking at metrics. They're not looking at quality. They're looking at volume. And then the politicians can use that to their advantage during elections. Well, at this point in time, guess who's bearing the brunt? Okay, the Muslims, Arabs, and South Asians. Now you're increasing. I mean, one issue, this doesn't go directly to your question, but terrorism-related prosecutions, there's a list that the National Security Division puts out under Justice of terrorism-related prosecutions. There are people in there who are accused of white-collar crime, fraud. Nothing to do with terrorism, nothing to do with 9/11. But they were put in there because they were prosecuted in 2001, 2002, 2003. And so they found some way to say, well, we don't know, and we think, okay, terrorism-related prosecution. So then they can go to Congress, and they can go to the public and say, look, you know those billions of dollars that you give us? We're using it really well. Keep giving us more. Give us more. We need more. We're still not safe enough. So I would have more oversight, particularly of this intergovernmental sharing. I would, you know, it's not within the Homeland Security Secretary's authority, but she certainly plays an influence in immigration reform. I mean, this is a huge issue. It's a political issue. But, for example, secure communities. I don't know if you guys have heard of this, but this is another just completely flawed process. Secure communities essentially, every time you're arrested, you haven't been charged even with a crime, you're arrested for I don't know what. Your fingerprints are taken when you go into jail, and now secure communities requires that those fingerprints get sent to the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and then they get checked, and then if you've got a problem, you're going to get detained by Immigration and Customs Enforcement and possibly deported. Goes back to the issue of local police doing the work of immigration officials, because then people will be scared to call the police. What's been happening, secure communities was passed politically with claiming, look, we're only going to be looking at those who have committed egregious crimes, violent crimes. That's fair. I mean, obviously, I don't want people who commit violent crimes. One, I want them prosecuted, and second, if they are illegal, I want them prosecuted and deported. I mean, we don't need any more criminals, okay? I get that. But that's not what's been happening. What's been happening is anyone who's arrested for the most minor thing, you got a tailgate, you didn't pay your registration, the cop wants to have an excuse to check your immigration papers, and he doesn't or she doesn't live in Arizona, they arrest you. And they know they'll let you go, you know, in a few hours and say, oh, I'm sorry, man, I'm so sorry about that. Well, guess what? Your fingerprints get in the system, and then your immigration status gets checked, and then the system. So that would be something. And they just, after months of political pressure by advocacy groups from all different ethnic communities, they finally relented, DHS, and said, okay, we're going to check our numbers because, yes, maybe we're abusing the system. Maybe we're not focusing on the violent criminals. But it was only after the advocacy groups and the public had to get informed and pressure them and saying, what are you doing? Because there's still a resource issue. For every single person that you're focusing on that hasn't committed a violent crime, there's another person that has that isn't getting the attention they need. There's only a certain amount of resources we've got in law enforcement. That's just a fact of life. So there's a very practical reason if you're not into the whole civil rights, you know, philosophy and you're just a realist. This is making you less safe from violent criminals. I mean, we could go on and on, but those are my initial thoughts. Although I highly doubt I will ever be the Secretary of Homeland Security. I don't think that I'm going to go through any confirmation in Senate.
And on that note, on behalf of Project Interfaith and the Center for Faith Studies at Countryside Community Church, we would like to thank Sahar Aziz for joining us today and offering her very thoughtful comments. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a program from Project Interfaith on Noon Forum. We've heard a lecture by Sahar Aziz, Associate Professor of Law at the Texas Wesleyan University School of Law, and former Senior Policy Advisor for the Office for Civil Rights and Civil Liberties at the United States Department of Homeland Security. She spoke on the topic, Then and Now, Civil Liberties and Interfaith Relations 10 Years After 9/11. Ms. Aziz's appearance was co-sponsored, along with Project Interfaith, by the Center for Faith Studies. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Sunday afternoon, September 11, 2011, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Beth Katz, Executive Director of Project Interfaith, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.